instead of debating how much of the surplus to spend and how much of it to save, you're probably facing withdrawal from savings.
A new budget reality for state lawmakers. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, January 23rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, researching the organisms that rode the tsunami debris dock that landed on the Oregon coast.
Some of them were probably feeding on other ones on the dock, sort of an island. It was an island in the ocean crossing the Pacific.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Kinnickarm Bridge and Toll Authority was created by the Alaska State Legislature to develop, stimulate, and advance the economic welfare of the state and further the development of public transportation systems. The authority has completed required environmental work to date, and the Federal Highway Administration has given its approval needed to move forward. There's more information at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnickarm Bridge and Toll Authority.
For the first time in nearly a decade, the state legislature is in a position where it could have to spend more money than it takes in. Fiscal analyst David Teal spoke before the Senate Finance Committee today, and he says that it's an unusual position for the state.
So you're back this year, and instead of debating how much of the surplus to spend and how much of it to save, you're probably facing withdrawal from savings.
Teal says using the governor's $13 billion spending proposal as a starting point, the legislature doesn't have a lot of wiggle room. When Governor Sean Parnell rolled that plan out, it was already pitched as a belt tightening. Last year, Parnell signed off on nearly $2 billion for capital projects like highway repairs and school renovations. This year, he wants to see that spending cut by half. And he wants to keep the operating budget nearly flat. Under his proposal, the legislature would have about $500 million to allocate as it pleases before having to withdraw from the state's savings. But that $500 million number isn't really accurate. Teal says it's far less, closer to half, $250 million. Since the governor's plan left out a major allocation to Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, and a chunk of that money is already a savings withdrawal. On top of that, Teal says a lot of the money may have to go toward padding the operating budget instead of toward building projects.
So my guess, and it's just a guess, is that you will not be able to spend the full surplus of 263 on capital projects unless you dip into savings. And that's because you're going to find it difficult to hold the operating budget to that 1% or $52 million increase.
The Legislative Finance Division's assessment found that operating costs may have to be increased because negotiations with the biggest state unions haven't concluded, and their requests aren't factored into the budget. Teal added some of the projections in the governor's budget don't match traditional operating costs, and there could be extra pressure this year to increase education funding. All that combined means the legislature could have to use some of the state's savings to craft the budget it wants. Teal says while that sounds scary, the state is still in relatively good shape.
I don't mean the message here to be gloom and doom. I don't think it is gloom and doom relative to other states' budgets.
Right now, the state has $16 billion saved in its reserves. Tsunami debris from Japan is fouling shorelines all along the west coast of the United States. It's also providing a unique research opportunity for scientists studying invasive species. At the Marine Science Symposium in Anchorage this week, Oregon State University Associate Professor Jessica Miller gave an update on her research work on the two massive docks that washed up in Oregon and Washington last year. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
It's rare for scientists to find perfect field experiments right in their backyard. But that's what happened last summer to Jessica Miller.
So there was a little bit of a buzz, actually, to be honest, in the hallway at work on, let's say that would have been the 5th of June, that, hey, something pretty big is on the beach.
The beach was just 4 miles from Miller's office, and that something turned out to be a giant dock that had been ripped loose in the 2011 Japanese earthquake and tsunami. When she first saw it, Miller says she was flabbergasted by just how huge it was, 66 feet long. That night, she called a few colleagues, and they agreed to meet at the beach the next morning with buckets and shovels.
Given the situation, we were fairly systematic, but it wasn't like we had planned a whole sampling design for a dock. We were just going, wow, I think we need to get these samples. So we tried to sample all the sides of the dock and probably got, I don't know, 35-gallon bags, and went back to the lab to begin kind of figuring out what was there.
The scientists quickly realized several of the species were potentially aggressively invasive. So a team from the state of Oregon scraped off all the living debris, took a blowtorch to the dock, and then buried 2 tons of organisms several feet down higher up on the beach. Then the research began. So far, Miller's team has documented 117 species that likely made the entire trip from Japan to Oregon.
And it really appears, given this diversity of animals, the reason some of them could survive on this dock for so long is some of them were probably feeding on other ones on the dock. It's sort of an island. It was an island in the ocean crossing the Pacific.
Miller says 11 of the species could be invasive, including the European blue mussel, the Japanese sea star, and the Asian pink barnacle. Miller says it's hard to predict how likely they are to become invasive, but if any do take hold, it will be a unique opportunity to study an invasive species from the moment of its arrival. One of the species Miller is most worried about is an Asian seaweed.
Undaria is a brown alga that was incredibly abundant on the dock and reproductive at the time. And it's already established in California. And it's on the one of the 100 worst invasive species lists already.
In late December, another dock washed up on a beach on Washington's Olympic Peninsula. It was from the same port in Japan and carried a similar mix of creatures with it across the ocean. Miller's team took samples from that dock as well. But she says invasive species from the tsunami debris aren't just arriving on huge objects like docks.
We've even found buoys. A buoy just came up into the Columbia River region, one of the large black buoys that a lot of people are reporting, with chitons, couple species of chitons, limpets, mussels, and I think an oyster on it, right? So you really can have a lot of even the smaller objects bringing in non-native species.
That has implications for Alaska. No large docks have washed up on shore in the state, but millions of pounds of debris are piling up on Alaska's beaches. So far, the state hasn't documented any invasive species from the debris. Chris Pallister with Gulf of Alaska Keeper helped clean up about 6 tons of tsunami debris from the southeast Kenai Peninsula last summer. He says he's worried about invasive species, but he's more worried about toxins from the debris.
I mean, you're talking thousands of miles of coastline that have been impacted by every kind of plastic you can imagine, and drums and containers of everything from nasty industrial chemicals to household cleaning products that are being scattered all up and down the intertidal environment.
Last summer, the state commissioned an aerial survey to document how much tsunami debris was washing up and where it was concentrating. The survey shows the debris stretches from the southern tip of southeast all the way around the Gulf of Alaska and at least partway down the Alaska Peninsula. But so far, no state funding and only a tiny amount of federal funding has been appropriated to begin cleaning it up. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Federal marine mammal authorities have proposed a recovery plan for a rare large whale, the North Pacific right whale. The National Marine Fisheries Service published the proposal today for the marine mammal that has been listed as endangered since the Endangered Species Act was passed in 1973. Right whales were decimated by whalers. Adults reach 45 to 55 feet, and whalers found them to be desirable prey because they're slow and buoyant after they're killed. Only about 30 right whales remain in U.S. waters. There are an estimated 900 that swim off Russia, Japan, and China. The Center for Biological Diversity in March gave a 60-day notice that it would sue if a recovery plan was not developed. The agency in April agreed to prepare the plan. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a high school class on mining opportunities in Alaska.
They come and talk to the students about how they got their job, the education required, and how they might take a path to get there.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska, and by
Providence Imaging Center, helping cancer patients stay in Anchorage with a PET scanner that fuses anatomical and functional images since 2004. Learn more at provimaging.com.
Transportation Commissioner Pat Kemp on Tuesday apologized for keeping the Marine Highway Advisory Board out of the loop on the Alaska class ferry. He and his staff also released a few more details on the vessel's proposed replacements. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
I sincerely apologize.
That's what Pat Kemp told the ferry advisory panel during their face-to-face meeting in Juneau. Here's a longer version of what he had to say.
I sincerely apologize for not keeping the board involved and not knowing more about the board. I wasn't involved with the board before, and in fact, when this whole thing was going down, taking place, I wasn't even a commissioner. I was acting commissioner, and I didn't know the sensitivities to the board. I don't know how you... I wasn't sure how the board operated.
Kemp used to be deputy commissioner for highways and public facilities. He was named acting commissioner in August and got the full appointment in December. He says he came into a leadership structure that isolated managers, and that's why he didn't know the rules of the road or the fact that the Alaska Class Ferry project was headed way over budget.
I was kind of in head-scratching mode for a while because I really didn't know what to do. I've developed projects my entire career, and I just had to get up to speed with this one.
Kemp decided the plan should be scrapped before an October advisory board meeting, but he couldn't bring it up without Governor Sean Parnell's approval. That came in December, when the governor announced plans to design two smaller, cheaper shuttle ships. Most Marine Transportation Advisory Board members criticized Kemp's handling of the design change. Angoon's Maxine Thompson represents Southeast Villages on the panel. She says she was blindsided.
Well, I was extremely frustrated because over the years we have worked really hard to develop a communication line, and we were under the impression that our input was appreciated. And so reading about it in the paper and responding to the people in the communities, you know, we were at a loss as to what happened.
Sitka's Jerry Hope, who represents Central Southeast, agrees.
We became accustomed to really being plugged in to the process and feeling like we had a positive role to play. And then when it was announced in the news, as other board members had identified, I was really surprised.
Some members had no complaint with the decision to drop the Alaska-class ferry design. They were happy to see what they considered an out-of-control project return to its simpler beginnings. Advisory Board Chairman Robert Venables says he accepts Kemp's apology.
Well, I thought that was somewhat unprecedented and very well received, and I think the board has had a very warm and close working relationship with the commissioner's office and the staff, and I'm glad to see that bridge mending underway.
Transportation officials told board members a few more details of the shuttle ferries, which will sail Lynn Canal. They say that system could create 15 to 25 jobs in Haines. That's in part because those traveling Juneau to Skagway, or the other way around, will need to change ships in Haines. Recently appointed Deputy Commissioner Reuben Yost says the latest Alaska class ferry plans could be used for another ship.
Basically, we have a preliminary design for a 350-foot Taku replacement. That will be on the shelf, and in the future, after the Tustamina is replaced, if the next vessel replaces the Taku, we are that much ahead in terms of design.
Kemp says more details of the new shuttle ferry plans will be released soon. He says the advisory board will be involved.
I'll have a close relationship with you. I like ferries. I like marine highway stuff. I think it's a great system, and the utmost confidence in Captain Falvey, the utmost confidence in Reuben, and I think we're going to be fine.
Kemp named Yost as one of three deputy transportation commissioners, but he will oversee other agencies and special projects along with the ferry system. Several legislators last week said state law requires such hires to go through the advisory board. Kemp says it's a different job and should not be covered by the legal language. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
More than 50 high school students taking an Intro to Mining Occupations course through the University of Alaska Southeast had a prominent guest speaker on the first day of class yesterday. Governor Sean Parnell urged them to follow their passions, whether they end up working in the mining industry or not. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
This class is a path of opportunity for you, and you're going to get out of it what you put into it.
Parnell spoke to the class for about 30 minutes, answering questions ranging from his thoughts on future mine development in Alaska to what he enjoys most about being governor. He talked about the importance of keeping mining jobs in state and praised classes like Intro to Mining Occupations for teaching Alaska students the skills needed to do that work.
These mining jobs often pay $100,000 a year, and it's really something to consider because we have a lot of prospects here in Alaska as well, and you've got an administration and a governor and a legislature who are focused on trying to open up new opportunities.
The governor was the first of many guest speakers the class will hear from this semester. Professor Mike Bell worked at Hecla Greens Creek Mine before becoming director of the Center for Mine Training at UAS. He says he's identified more than 140 mining-related careers, everything from cooks to truck drivers to wastewater treatment engineers.
I'm not going to instruct in all of these fields because I don't have that kind of expertise. I've worked at Greens Creek Mine for 5 years and been a professor here for 6 or 7, but there are a lot of jobs that I don't know about. So what I do is I call up a mine engineer maybe at Greens Creek or at CORE, and they come and talk to the students about how they got their job, the education required, and how they might take a path to get there.
This is the second year Bell has taught the class, designed for high school juniors and seniors. Last year, enrollment was limited to 20 students, all from Juneau. But this year, with the help of video conferencing equipment, there are 55 students statewide, from the Northwest Arctic Borough to remote parts of Southeast.
I went down to Prince of Wales to talk to all the schools there because there are two big mines that are starting up down there, and they want a local workforce. So we're trying to show the kids what happens at those mines.
Isaac Rumfelt is a 17-year-old senior at Juneau's Thunder Mountain High School who's interested in a career as a mechanic.
I kind of got into diesel mechanics and figured out I could get into diesel mechanics at the mine. So thought it'd be good to learn what goes on at the mine on a daily basis and basics of everything, kind of.
The students pay $44 tuition and receive 3 college credits, according to Roxanne Morant with the State Department of Education and Early Development. The department is one of several partners that make the class possible. That includes mining companies like Hecla, which donated $300,000 to the University of Alaska Foundation in 2011 to help create the mine training program at UAS. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Older Persons Action Group, promoting well-being for Alaska seniors and their families, including publication of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper. Membership information at 1-800-478-1059. The Quality Inn and Suites on Spinard, providing lodging for Medicare patients in Anchorage with a 24-hour airport shuttle and a hot continental breakfast. Reservations at 800-221-7550. And by Alaska Executive Search, providing temporary or full-time staffing for over 36 years, from executive and technical placement to medical in-office staffing. Alaska Executive Search, online at akexec.com.
The University of Alaska Fairbanks is pushing ahead with a plan to replace its aging power and heating plant. The current facility, built in 1962, will be replaced with one that still primarily relies on coal, but can also burn other fuels, including biomass and natural gas. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Fairbanks only has limited access to natural gas trucked in from Cook Inlet, while abundant, low-cost coal is delivered readily by rail from the nearby Usabelli mine at Healy. That's why coal will remain the fuel of choice at the University of Alaska Fairbanks' proposed new power plant. Chancellor Brian Rogers, who highlighted the project during a presentation to the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce, said coal costs the university about $8 million a year, compared to $39 million if it uses oil. But he also acknowledged air quality concerns, noting that the new plant will have better controls for regulated pollutants.
We're looking at a NOx decrease of 65%, carbon monoxide decrease is 44%, particulates, two-thirds in particulates, 38% decrease in PM2.5, and we're already relatively low on the PM2.5 because we have a baghouse that is capturing most of the particulate matter already. Sulfur dioxide, a 71% decrease. So significant decreases in those six regulated.
Rogers said there will be no change in output of two other pollutants, CO2 and volatile organic compounds. The updated fluidized bed technology coal plant will get more heat out of the fuel. Rogers calls it the best choice given economic and environmental factors, noting that the university is also pursuing solar generation and load reduction, including $6 million in lighting efficiency upgrades. Rogers said the university is submitting permit applications for the power plant this week.
We'll have all the information online available to all in March. We anticipate a public comment period in June, July, and a potential final permit completed in September. We have a request to the legislature this year for planning and design. We're still working on the cost estimate, but likely is in the $225 to $250 million.
Rogers said the project scheduled for completion by 2018 is just one part of university-wide upgrades needed to ready the Fairbanks campus for the next 50 years, including replacement of the electrical distribution system and wastewater lines. The new Margaret Marie Life Sciences building is scheduled for dedication in August, while March 30th groundbreakings are planned for new engineering and dining facilities at UAF. Rogers also mentioned a new ski and snowboard terrain park scheduled to open on campus this spring, noting recent support from a private donor. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
A former national reporter has jumped ship from covering the news to being part of it. Wen Stevenson, who wrote for the Boston Globe, The Atlantic, and NPR, says he's lost patience with the lack of progress on climate change legislation. He wrote an online article earlier this winter taking reporters to task for not covering climate change as a crisis. He says when he does see coverage on climate, it's very narrowly focused.
We tend to obsess over the scientific debate around, you know, exactly to what degree scientists can say that Superstorm Sandy was caused or not caused by climate change. Instead of stepping back and looking at the big picture and what Sandy suggests for the future, in terms of, you know, the conversation that we need to be having about what we're going to do about the crisis, there's really almost no sense of urgency and of the actual scale and severity of the situation. We're stuck on what is considered politically possible and feasible or realistic at this moment, and that's what gets discussed, rather than what is actually necessary to be done.
Do you have an example of either when it's done right, or what should news reporters and editors be doing about these stories?
The International Energy Agency, the IEA, not exactly a lot of woolly environmentalists, released their 2012 World Energy Outlook, and there's a section in there on what would be required to hit the 2-degree target. And what they're saying is that somewhere on the order of 2/3 to 80% of proven fossil fuel reserves globally need to stay in the ground between now and 2050. And they're saying that this is going to be rather difficult. PricewaterhouseCoopers, the consulting arm, PwC, has released a new report called Too Late for 2 Degrees. And they are saying it's highly unrealistic that the world can actually reduce, that the global economy can reduce its carbon intensity fast enough. They say at a pace of 5% or more per year for the next 4 decades in order to keep temperatures below 2 degrees Celsius. All right. The World Bank released a new report saying that they're saying that the 2-degree target is looking impossible, and that we're actually on course for a 4-degree Celsius rise by the end of the century, or maybe even 6 degrees, and it would be catastrophic.
How can you promote a sense of urgency without freaking people out to the point that they despair and just give up, thinking it's too late or too large to tackle?
That's a very good question. I think about that a lot, and I think the main thing to keep in mind, okay, is just what MIT climate scientist Kerry Emanuel said, has said to me, and that I mentioned in my Phoenix article, is that of course there is always uncertainty around the models built into the models, you know, and the projections of climate impacts. You know, we don't know exactly how severe or when exactly, how fast the impacts of climate change will arrive. So even though it's looking awfully grim at this point, it's looking awfully hard for us to prevent some potentially catastrophic warming, there's still a range of possible outcomes here. There's a range of possibilities. So it's never too late, to fight. There's still plenty left to fight for. And when you think about what's at stake here, when you think about that it's our own children and grandchildren, you know, people who are alive today and who will be alive in the latter part of this century who are going to start seeing the worst impacts of this. I mean, how can you look your own children or grandchildren in the eyes and not want to fight for them?
Wen Stevenson is a former journalist who has become a full-time climate change awareness activist. Finally tonight, we have a correction. In a story last evening, we reported that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission had yielded to pressure from Alaska Governor Sean Parnell and members of the state legislature to amend its timelines for the Susitna-Watonna Hydroelectric Dam study process, reporting that FERC rescinded their December 31st judgment that 13 of 58 studies were inadequate was incorrect. FERC did not reverse its decision to alter the timeline. FERC stood by its directive to Alaska Energy Authority to provide more study details on 13 proposed studies. FERC did shorten the public comment period. Jan Konigsberg was misidentified in the story. Konigsberg is an independent observer of the Susitna-Watonna Hydroelectric Project. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
And by
Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you. Online now for your 2013 PFD. Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2013 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give, or contributing to a college savings plan. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the state of Alaska.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.